Welcome to Yale Cancer Center Answers with your hosts, Drs. Francine Foss, Anish Chagpar, and Stephen Gore. Dr. Foss is a professor of medicine in the section of medical oncology at the Yale Cancer Center. Dr. Chagpar is associate professor of surgical oncology and director of the breast center at Smilow Cancer Hospital. And Dr. Gore is director of hematological malignancies at Smilow. Yale Cancer Center Answers features weekly conversations about the research, diagnosis, and treatment of cancer. And if you'd like to join the conversation, you can submit questions and comments to canceranswers@yale.edu, or you can leave a voicemail message at 888-234-4YCC. This week, you'll hear a conversation about stem cell transplantation with Dr. Stuart Seropian. Dr. Seropian is an associate professor of medicine and hematology at Yale School of Medicine. Here's Stephen Gore.
Why don't you tell us, what is a stem cell transplant?
Well, there's a couple of different types. I'm sure we'll get into that. But the basic idea is to use hematopoietic stem cells.
Hematopoietic?
Yeah. So these are cells that help make blood. So they're not embryonic stem cells. You hear a lot in the news about controversy. This is not a controversial subject. These are stem cells that help to make blood. And we use them in cancer therapy to support the administration of chemotherapy. And sometimes also to try and give people a new immune system to try and fight cancer.
Okay, so you're telling me that there's two functions of stem cells, and how do stem cells support chemotherapy? I don't understand that.
Well, so a lot of cancers of the blood or immune system are curable with systemic chemotherapy, but not all cancers. So a good example is acute leukemia, acute myeloid leukemia in older patients. It's very hard to cure with standard chemotherapy. Some of these cancers may be cured if we give very high doses of chemotherapy, but then the blood counts will get very low, patients will get very sick, and sometimes it's really not possible to do that. If we have a source of healthy stem cells that can make blood, we can use them after the administration of high doses of chemotherapy to make the administration of the high-dose chemo safer.
So in other words, if you just gave the high-dose chemo, people's blood counts would take a long time to recover, and they might get sick or die. But the new stem cells do what?
This is really blood therapy. A lot of people think sometimes they hear transplant, maybe there's surgery involved. This is really transfusion therapy, where stem cells may be obtained from a patient or maybe from a donor, and they're administered like a transfusion, and they'll go through the blood to the bone marrow, and they'll just start making stem cells the way our blood stem cells do so ordinarily throughout life.
Fascinating. So you mentioned that there's different sources of stem cells. And can you go into that a little more? Different kinds of where the stem cells come from, what the patient or
sure.
Donor?
Sure, absolutely. So if our goal is to try and give very high-dose chemotherapy, so take, for instance, a disease like non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, we can collect the stem cells from the patient. We're using their own stem cells. Nowadays, we harvest them out of the bloodstream through a process of filtering the blood called apheresis, and they can be frozen. And then they're thawed out and administered to the patient after we give a high dose of chemotherapy for the purpose of having a faster recovery of the blood counts to make the procedure safer. We can get similar cells out of the bone marrow, so that's what a bone marrow transplant is, although if we are using the patient's own cells, we tend to get more cells if we collect them out of the blood. That would be called a peripheral blood stem cell transplant. Now, certain diseases, that works well. Other diseases, it doesn't quite work as well because we need more than just the high-dose chemotherapy to try and cure the disease. That's when we might consider a sibling as a donor of the stem cells, or even an unrelated volunteer. And there are some new sources of stem cells like umbilical cord blood. So those are more complicated transplants. They require a donor, and we really are replacing the immune system. So we think of that like an organ transplant, like if someone needed a new kidney or a new heart in part. But as I mentioned before, there's the added benefit of a new immune system to fight the cancer as well.
Well, I'm definitely going to want to talk to you more about that. But just to finish up on this high-dose therapy where people are giving their own stem cells to help them recover better, aren't you worried about giving them back their cancer cells? How does that work?
Yeah, that is a concern. And in fact, there's been a lot of research over the years to try and reduce the risk of that. So a simple way to try and reduce the risk of that is to collect the stem cells at a time when a patient has been treated and they've already gone into a good remission. And in fact, those are the situations where using a patient's cells and giving the high-dose chemotherapy is most likely to work. So we're giving a patient treatment to get them in a remission. Often this is in a patient who's relapsed, so we're getting them in a second remission. And then we collect the stem cells at a time where there really is very little disease left in the body. And the high-dose chemotherapy is to try and eradicate that small amount of stubborn disease that's left. And in most cases in diseases like lymphoma or Hodgkin's disease, for example, the tumor cell contamination, which is what we call that, is minimal. There are diseases like multiple myeloma where we probably do collect some tumor cells. Whether they survive the freezing process is uncertain, but they don't appear to contribute to relapse in a material way.
So are these transplants where people are getting their own stem cells back delivered with the intent of curing the patient or just giving them a remission, or how does that work?
It depends on the disease. So in a disease like relapsed Hodgkin's disease or non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, like a large cell lymphoma, which is the most common kind of lymphoma, we are doing that procedure with curative intent. When we use a patient's own stem cells, this is in general a safer procedure. There aren't as many expected complications. So there are other diseases like multiple myeloma where we don't think we're going to cure the patient, but for many patients, they benefit in terms of a better remission, a longer remission, and it has a place in their therapy along with other agents we use to treat that disease.
Very interesting. So why don't you tell me, why would I want a new immune system? Why would that be helpful to me?
Well, transplantation started in the late 60s and 70s with the idea of giving high-dose chemotherapy, as we were just discussing. And in the cases where transplants were performed with a donor, it became evident, really later on in the 80s and 90s in particular, that the immune system that we were transferring to the recipient was really helping to fight the cancer. And we know that high-dose chemotherapy can really help some patients, but it doesn't help as much in certain diseases, particularly if they're not responding well to standard chemotherapy. So diseases like acute myeloid leukemia, we think there's an extra benefit of a donor's immune system fighting the cancer. And in fact, we know pretty confidently from really clinical experiments like giving extra immune cells from a donor after a transplant to treat recurrent disease, that the immune system really can help to fight lots of different malignancies. Hmm. So that would be a reason if one feels like the high-dose chemotherapy isn't going to eradicate the cancer, then we might turn to a donor where we get the added benefit of the immune system to help try and improve the cure rate.
Hmm. So wouldn't everybody who has one of these hard-to-treat diseases automatically, if they had a donor, want to get something like that? I mean, it seems like I want that extra immune boost to try to cure my leukemia no matter what.
That's right. And in a perfect world, if we could do those types of transplants with the same level of low risk as transplants using a patient's own cells, we probably would do that. Giving a new immune system is a more complicated procedure. It carries some extra risks that we don't have to worry about with an autologous transplant. And the main one is an illness called graft versus host disease.
All right, so just to remind everybody, the autologous transplant, that's the one where you get your own cells. Is that right?
That's right.
And what do you call this one with other?
So that's called an allogeneic transplant.
Allogeneic transplant is somebody else's stem cells.
So a sibling, brother or sister, unrelated volunteer donor, a cord blood transplant. This is coming from another individual, a family member maybe who's not matched. This is sometimes used. That's a new technique to try and get a new immune system. So anytime the cells come from somebody else, that's an allogeneic transplant.
Okay, Stuart, maybe you could walk us through what happens to a patient who is undergoing one of these allogeneic transplants? What, I mean, do they just come in and get infused with cells? Is this, could you maybe walk
sure,
me through that?
Sure. So the let's take a patient who has acute myeloid leukemia, as that's one of the most common indications for an allogeneic transplant. These patients are always treated with chemotherapy at the time of diagnosis, and then a determination is made if a transplant is necessary. That's made by their leukemia doctor in collaboration with a transplant physician. Some patients may have a transplant as part of their initial therapy. Some patients may have standard chemotherapy, hope they're cured, and save a transplant for a later date. But if a transplant is indicated, a donor has to be identified, so that's the first step. So there's simple blood tests or sometimes a cotton swab of the mouth to test genes that govern how the immune systems relate to each other, and we look for a matched donor. Interestingly, you don't have to be the same blood type as your donor. It helps a little bit, but it's really not crucial. But we do tissue typing called HLA typing, and we find a donor, hopefully in the family. If not, we look in the National Registry. We may look for a cord blood. Once we have identified a donor and scheduled a time for the donor cells to be collected, then the patient will be scheduled to come into the hospital for a transplant. So as a general outline, patients receive chemotherapy with or without radiation, and that's usually administered over a period of as few as 4 days or up to 10 days. And then the stem cells that have been collected from the donor are infused like a blood transfusion. And there's a period where the blood counts are low because the treatment we've given is usually fairly intensive. And we wait for the blood counts to recover. It's usually a period of about 2 weeks.
It takes that long for the stem cells to grow?
That's right. So the blood counts will be low for that period of time because of the effects of the chemotherapy we've given or the radiation. Once the blood counts recover, most people leave the hospital in 4 to 7 days. And because we've given cells from a donor where the immune system is different, there are special medicines that need to be administered to make sure that part of the immune system from the donor don't make the patient sick. So that's this graft versus host disease illness we were speaking of.
But I thought you said the patients were matched and you were doing that cotton swab and stuff.
So the matching serves to allow us to do these types of procedures without a real risk of the patient rejecting the donor cells. So the risk of there is a risk of rejecting donor cells if patients don't have these same genes. But unless you have an identical twin, the immune systems between individuals still vary greatly, even if they're matched for these major genes. Hmm. If there are lots of other genes that we know are just different between everybody, including people who are related to each other, and if we tried to match every single gene that exists for this, we would never find an appropriate donor if we were that strict. So these are the major genes that really govern the safety of the procedure, but we still need to use some method to control the donor's immune system for a period of time. It's a little different to anyone who knows someone who had a kidney transplant or a heart transplant knows those recipients of an organ for another individual have to take rejection prophylaxis for their whole life, but that's not true of an allogeneic transplant when we're doing it for leukemia or the cancers of the blood.
So they don't need to stay on this anti-rejection drug forever?
If drugs are being used, if that's the method we're using to prevent this problem of graft versus host disease, usually patients are on those medicines for 4 to 6 months, and then we try to remove them. Some people do have to take them for a longer period of time.
All right. Well, that's fascinating. We're going to take a short break for a medical minute. Please stay tuned to learn more about stem cell transplantation with Dr. Stuart Seropian.
There are over 13 million cancer survivors in the United States and over 100,000 here in Connecticut. Completing treatment for cancer is an exciting milestone, but cancer and its treatment can be a life-changing experience. Following treatment, cancer survivors can face several long-term side effects of cancer, including heart problems, osteoporosis, fertility issues, and an increased risk of second cancers. Resources for cancer survivors are available at federally designated comprehensive cancer centers to keep cancer survivors well and focused on healthy living. The Survivorship Clinic at Yale Cancer Center focuses on providing guidance and direction to empower survivors to take steps to maximize their health, quality of life and longevity. This has been a Medical Minute, brought to you as a public service by Yale Cancer Center and Smilow Cancer Hospital at Yale New Haven. More information is available at yalecancercenter.org. You're listening to WNPR, Connecticut's public media source for news and ideas.
This is Dr. Stephen Gore, and our guest tonight is Dr. Stuart Seropian. We are discussing the role of stem cell transplantation for the treatment of cancer. Stuart, before the break, you were walking us through this kind of transplantation where people get cells from people other than themselves, donors other than themselves, that you called allogeneic transplant. And you were telling us that once the new stem cells were making a new immune system, there could be this problem where the new cells were doing something bad to the patient. Did I get that right?
Right, right. That's graft versus host disease. So the graft is how we refer to the donor cells, and the host is the patient. So this is an illness that can develop if some of the cells in the donor's immune system recognize parts of the recipient as different and then cause inflammation. So one of the more common problems that patients might experience is just a rash, because the cells from the donor see something in the skin of the recipient that looks different to them, and they'll attack those tissues because that's the function of the immune system, is to protect from foreign proteins or infectious agents or just tissues that are different. Other manifestations of graft versus host disease include inflammation in the bowel, the GI tract, that can result in symptoms like nausea or loose bowel movements, or the liver. So those are the more common sites that could be affected.
That sounds really dangerous if the liver were attacked.
That's actually less common nowadays, and graft versus host disease is a illness that can be mild or severe. So it's not an illness that if it happens, there's no way to treat it and the transplant will fail. It's something we want to prevent because it contributes quite a bit to the morbidity or potentially mortality of the procedure. As I mentioned, this is what makes allogeneic transplant more complicated.
So the patient who's undergoing the transplant is probably hoping, I just hope I don't ever get graft versus host disease. Is that right? It sounds like always a bad thing.
It's kind of a double-edged sword. And what I mean by that is we're selecting to do that type of transplant when we're hoping the donor's immune system will fight the leukemia or the lymphoma, whatever the disease is that we're having trouble with standard treatments.
How does that work?
And so we know that the immune system can fight leukemia, and that seems most commonly to be observed in patients who get some graft versus host disease at some point after the transplant. It's not required, and patients will often tell me they're worried that they know there's a potential for the donor's immune system to fight the leukemia, for instance, and that they've heard that if they get some graft versus host disease, that's a good thing, and they haven't gotten it yet. And that's not exactly the case. You don't have to get graft versus host disease to get an effect from the donor's immune system. We call that graft versus leukemia when the donor cells are fighting the leukemia. The first order of business when we do a transplant is to prevent graft versus host disease, because it really can make patients very sick. But it is one of the reasons why we don't want to keep people on the immunosuppressive drugs that we use to prevent this forever. So we try and stop those drugs when we think a safe period has elapsed where there's no problem that's obvious. And then we hope the donor's immune system sort of wakes up and starts to do its thing in terms of fighting the disease. And we in fact, know historically over many years that in patients who still have some leukemia after a transplant, sometimes when we stop those immunosuppressive drugs and we allow the donor's immune system to sort of wake up and start to work, that patients will go into remission without our giving any chemotherapy. Or sometimes we'll give a boost of cells from the donor, which is usually not very complicated. If a patient has a family member who's been a donor, we just have them come back in and collect some blood. And we give that to the patient as a boost to the immune cells that we're looking to fight the leukemia.
Wow. I'm getting a visual of like the old Pac-Man game with the little guy gobbling up all the enemies. Is it something like that?
That's just kind of how we like to think about it. And the correlations with the donor's immune system really fighting the leukemia seem to be best in people who develop what we call chronic graft-versus-host disease, and that's a form of graft-versus-host disease that tends to happen later on, often after we've stopped the immunosuppressive drugs, and that is often a milder form of graft-versus-host disease. The stuff that could happen in the first few months, we don't think that's going to help so much to fight the leukemia. We're just trying to prevent that.
Hmm. Is there any way to pick among a bunch of donors to say which one's going to be the best at getting this graft-versus leukemia effect? That sounds so cool.
There are some experimental things, but the first order of business is to have a well-matched donor, and we have to sort of choose safety first when it comes to choosing donors.
Gotcha. So it sounds to me, though, like this whole thing is pretty complicated, and you'd probably have to be an Olympic athlete or a very young person to tolerate all this chemo and then transplant. So what is the upper age limit, 40, 45, 50?
That's one of the major changes, I would say, at least since I've been in practice. When I started, the upper age limit for transplantation was in most institutions around the age of 55. And the reason for that was because probably the hardest thing to tolerate is the high-dose chemotherapy part of the procedure. Now that we recognize that a very important part of curing cancers with this type of transplant really is just related to the immune system helping, there have been methods devised to do transplant without the high-dose chemotherapy part. There's always some chemotherapy or radiation that's required, but this can be done with milder treatment that really just ensures that the patient accepts the donor graft. So that's referred to typically as reduced intensity transplant or non-myeloablative transplant is another term. And because that's a much milder therapy, we've been able to extend the age limit up quite a bit. So most institutions don't have a strict age cutoff anymore. It's really more of a evaluation of the physical health of the patient. As a practical matter, I would say that patients in their early 70s are still considered candidates for transplantation, rarely older than that. Usually it's just a matter of patients having other medical problems where it doesn't seem likely to be safe. But patients routinely in their 60s with diseases like leukemia, myelodysplasia, lymphoma are considered for transplant. And we don't really count people out until we do an evaluation to see really how healthy they are and talk about the risks and benefits of a transplant procedure versus the alternatives.
Hmm. Well, that's certainly a big change since 25 years ago or so when I started in the field. And
right.
In those days, I would be too old to get a transplant at age 56 for sure. Well, that's really, really interesting. What happens to the patients who don't have any siblings? I'm assuming that if I have a sibling, then I've got a donor. Is that right?
You actually have just the way the genetics work, you have a 1 in 4 chance of being matched with one of your siblings. So, in fact, if you only have a few siblings, you may not have a donor in the family.
Wait, one out of four, no matter how many siblings you have?
So if you have a couple of siblings, then the chances are increased.
I got it.
It doesn't double for each sibling. So you can either be fully matched, half matched, or not matched at all. And if patients don't have a family donor, depending on their ethnicity, we look in the National Registry, which is linked worldwide now to registries in other countries, and there's a good chance of finding a suitable donor through the registry. There's over 9 million volunteer donors.
Wow.
Who've had some form of tissue typing in the registry that we can go and look and see if there might be a match there. Beyond that, umbilical cord bloods are also a potential alternative donor source. So cord bloods are collected at the time the babies are born, and they're frozen in cord blood banks. And you can look for those through the registries or directly through cord blood banks.
Wait, they get the blood out of the umbilical cord?
That's right.
That's a short little thing.
Yeah. There's not a lot of cells in there, but it's enriched with stem cells.
Hmm.
And so that's become a very popular source of stem cells for pediatrics because the number of cells needed is in relation to the size of the recipient. So as you would imagine, you can have a lot more cells per pound of recipient in the pediatric population. It's done in adults as well, and that's a alternative. And then there's been work in the last 10 years that looks very promising for choosing family donors who are only partially matched, and the special techniques that have been developed to try and make those transplants work.
Well, that can't be very safe.
So the major concern over the years has been that any form of mismatching will result in a higher risk of graft versus host disease, and that in general is the case. There are ways to give certain chemotherapy drugs to patients who've had a mismatched transplant where we can reduce the risk of graft versus host disease. So there's lots of different ways to look for a source of these cells in patients when we think an allogeneic transplant is the best treatment for them.
Hmm. So what percent of people eventually can find a donor?
So start to finish, over half. So unfortunately, if one is an ethnic minority, if there isn't a family donor, it's harder to find a donor through the registry or through a cord blood. Those patients may be patients where a partially matched transplant would be considered. Cord blood also would be considered.
Well, it sounds like there's still a need to increase the number of donors who are available. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Could you tell us if our listeners were interested in becoming a donor or being available to be a donor for an unrelated person?
Sure.
How would they go about that?
Sure. The most direct way would be to go online to marrow.org, the National Marrow Donor website, and just follow the links to look for the process for becoming a donor. And donors would receive a kit where it's just a cotton swab that they run over the surface of the inside of their mouth, and this collects enough DNA for the tissue typing to be done. Kind of like the O.J. Simpson case where the DNA was tested that way.
Right.
So it's very simple. It's not a blood test. It's easy. There's no obligation. If people sign up for the registry, they could be called and told that they might be a match, and then they would have to go in and give a blood sample and have a medical evaluation if they might be a donor. But signing up for anything other than getting listed on the registry.
Does it cost the donor anything to be on the registry?
There's a small fee for the kit. I think it's $50 or $60 now.
Okay. And does it eventually cost the donor money, or does their insurance get charged if they have to be a donor?
No. If one does get selected as a donor, there are no costs to the donor. Those are covered by the recipient's insurance.
And what if my wife were expecting a baby and I wanted to store this umbilical cord blood? First of all, I know that my youngest daughter's getting up there in age, but we were approached by some places that wanted us to spend a lot of money to put her umbilical cord blood in the freezer for in case she got sick later. So is that what people have to do, to pay a lot of money to be on the umbilical cord registry?
Well, so there's two different options here we're talking about, and I certainly have a bias in this regard because I treat patients who have cancer, and it's always difficult if you're having trouble finding a donor for a patient who needs a transplant. Cord bloods can be collected and frozen with the registry, but those are donated to the registry for the use of the general population. So if someone has a baby next month and the cord blood goes to the registry, a couple of days later there could be a request for that cord blood, and it could be used for an unrelated individual. And I think that right now is the best use of cord bloods. There certainly is a need, as we mentioned, particularly in ethnic minorities, for more grafts for patients who can't find donors. There's a lot of companies that will freeze cord blood for individuals for later use, either for that baby or for a family member. A lot of the uses are unknown right now, and there's not a lot of regulation, and there's a financial burden. We don't know how long those cells are going to be viable for, and we also don't always know exactly what the quality control is about the way the cells are frozen and maintained. So I encourage people to donate to the registry if they're willing. I think it's really a great cause.
All right. And do they just ask their OB about that, or how does that work?
That's the place to start.
Dr. Stuart Seropian is an associate professor of medicine and hematology at Yale School of Medicine. We invite you to share your questions and comments. You can send them to canceranswers@yale.edu or leave a voicemail message at 888-234-4YCC. And as an additional resource, archived programs from 2006 through the present are available in both audio and written versions at yalecancercenter.org. We'd like to thank the Yale Cancer Center for providing production support as part of the Connecting Our Communities initiative. And we'd also like to thank Renee Gaudette, Emily Fenton, and the staff of the Yale Broadcast and Media Center. I'm Bruce Barber, hoping you'll join us again next Sunday evening at 6 for another edition of Yale Cancer Center Answers here on WNPR, Connecticut's public media source for news and ideas.